Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Watch out for that catering bill. It's time for another Flat Chat. The very latest issue of GP Racing magazine hit the shelves last week. In it, we take a look at Max Verstappen's journey to his second world championship and smashing Formula One's toughest record, that of 13 wins in a season. Or, as Mrs. Codling put it after the Brazilian Grand Prix, bet you wish you hadn't put that petulant little twerp on the cover of your magazine now, eh? Well, it is with some trepidation that we prepared to tweet an image of said cover. And lo, the fury began, shall we say. But anyway, before we dig into that, time to introduce my guests. Once again, we are multinational. Not as multinational as when we tried to record it last week with Matt freshly landed in Abu Dhabi. Now he's had an opportunity to... land and recover. How is the jet lag, Matt?
Not too bad, thank you. It was more painful on the way out with an overnight flight and then trucking from Dubai to Abu Dhabi. And I think my colleagues had some reservations about my lane discipline on sort of 40 minutes of sleep, but it wasn't too bad. But I've fully recovered on the way back. And if I may plug Autosport at this point, Stuart, or Codders, as you are better known, I'm smashing out season review stuff, so fully up to speed and delivering my best, I hope.
By smashing out, do you mean finally crafting?
Absolutely, absolutely. Diligently delivering my absolute best. It's just coincidence that they happen to be making all the deadlines. I'm not rushing through it.
Well, you know, 'twas ever thus with Autosport, insane schedules and the need to make 48 hours in a single day. Someone who an ex Autosport employee currently also enjoying some weird sort of time travel from Adelaide, Mark Gallagher.
Hi. Yes, it's 20 to 9 in the evening, and I make no secret of the fact that while I'm talking to you, I've got a glass of wine sitting beside me. So you're having your first...
Nice local wine.
You're having your first coffee of the day. Matt's having a tea or whatever. You're having a hydrating water. I'm having a relaxing glass of vino, which is quite appropriate because we're in the vineyards in South Australia here.
Massively jealous as ever of the whole business of wintering in Australia. How is it now? Because obviously, you know, the last couple of years have been a bit difficult in terms of getting there because of COVID and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think we, so 2 years ago, I think we did a podcast when I had just completed 2 weeks of hotel quarantine, which was an interesting experience. I have a certificate from the South Australian government to confirm that I passed the examination of 2 weeks quarantine, so I don't know if I'll ever get that framed. That's possibly the greatest qualification I've ever had, really, 2 weeks quarantine in a hotel. But last few years have been difficult, and one thing that's very clear is that you know, this year in Melbourne. We had an amazing Grand Prix down here this year. The huge crowds, you know, almost record crowds for the Australian Grand Prix this year. And again, I've only been here about a week. Everyone's again all talking about Formula One Melbourne. Even though Melbourne's the third Grand Prix of the season, they haven't managed to return to their first spot in the championship. But everyone's just, you know, so behind it. And this week, down in Australia, the big kind of talking point has been Daniel Ricciardo's final race for McLaren and what's going to happen to him. I had a few news channels call me up and ask me to talk about what I thought might happen to Daniel in the future. But, you know, having said all of that, of course, the Aussies are terribly excited about the future for Oscar Piastri. So, you know, it's there's a lot of excitement around Formula One down here, and COVID is well and truly not over, but contained. There's a lot more mask wearing here than there is in Europe at the moment, with some countries in Asia, notably China, which we might talk about during the podcast in terms of the Grand Prix. There's a kind of an awareness in Australia that if any of the Asian countries get out of control with COVID, you know, could that impact on Australia once again? So they're being a little bit cautious, but otherwise, business is normal.
Daniel Ricciardo, it's a bit of a shame, isn't he? Because he's one of the sport's great characters, and it's no coincidence that he's very often front and centre on the Netflix show, whereas other drivers perhaps have a little bit less screen time. Mentioning no names, Lance Stroll, who you might think wasn't actually a Formula One driver based on his screen time there. What do you think that Australia's interest will be sustained because of Oscar Piastri? Yeah. Is it kind of like that little bit in Pirates of the Caribbean when Johnny Depp's character is introduced and he's sort of standing on the top mast of a ship that is gently subsiding beneath the waves, and as it disappears beneath the ocean in a slightly weird piece of geography, he leaps off it onto the jetty.
Yeah. I did think about that at the time, but anyway, let's not go into the detail of Pirates of the Caribbean direction and production. The fact is that in Australia, there's a huge love for Daniel Ricciardo. Talking to some folks this week, I think there's a slight sense that, you know, is he going to be remembered as the kind of fun guy of Formula One rather than the 8 times Grand Prix winner and the guy who was a great overtaker and who used to send it. And, you know, is somehow his legacy going to be more about the smiley, fun Daniel Ricciardo rather than the arch competitor that he was, particularly in his Red Bull racing days? And, you know, I think that's interesting because the Australians are extremely proud of their sporting heritage, and they saw Daniel as their man and someone who could perhaps one day go for the world championship. So I think this is a little bit of disappointment. One of the questions I've been asked by a lot of people were very much, you know, I did a Sky News Australia interview on Monday morning, and they asked me, you know, will this be a sabbatical? And they said, you know, Mika Häkkinen famously went off on a sabbatical and then never came back. Well, of course, the truth is that Mika Häkkinen never went on a sabbatical. He actually retired completely. It was Ron Dennis who decided to tell the world that Mika was on a sabbatical because Ron was desperate to have Mika come back again. But in Mika's own mind, it was made up that he was never coming back. And I think with Daniel, it's going to be such an interesting few months ahead because, you know, as David Coulthard has said, is Daniel going to be able to unpack whatever it has happened to him? Is he going to be able to simplify his life, get to a point where he rediscovers his motivation, his focus, or actually is he going to step away and really enjoy not being in Formula One and enjoy the fact that, you know, he's made very good money and he's got a very nice lifestyle? And I think Daniel himself has been very clear about the fact that he needs to step back. So it's going to be really interesting few months. I personally am really interested to see what happens when he steps inside hopefully a Red Bull. You know, if he was to get into a Red Bull in pre-season testing next year and be allowed to do half a day, you know, would he come out of that car transformed? Because perhaps it was a McLaren-specific thing which really ultimately robbed him off his motivation. And at the age he is, I mean, particularly compared to Fernando Alonso, who's 8 years older than him, you know, Daniel ought to have time and decide if he wanted to come back. And I think in Australia, you know, they'd love to see him come back. But there's no question that Piastri is seen by certainly the Australian motorsport fraternity and F1 fans as an extremely interesting and fascinating sort of new era. And the fact that he's replaced Daniel at McLaren and the fact that Mark Webber manages Piastri, you know, that kind of, I think, in on the part of fans here, more than makes up for the fact that they've lost Daniel Ricciardo, at least for the time being. So anyway, whatever happens, Australian interest in Formula One remains as strong as ever, absolutely undiminished. And I think they'll just be interested. I think everyone really is interested to see what kind of Daniel Ricciardo comes on our TV screens, perhaps during the latter part of next year. Are we going to see him reinvigorated and determined to come back, or actually enjoying the fact that he doesn't have the relentless pressure of Formula One anymore?
Hopefully he won't turn out to be one of these drivers who becomes a rent-a-quote, mentioning no names, Jacques Villeneuve, Ralf Schumacher. At the time of recording, it is a potential deal to be Red Bull's third driver. I mean, it may just be confirmed while our producer Martin is undergoing the lengthy and turgid process of cutting all the libels out of this podcast prior to uploading. In the magazine this month, we have a Red Bull driver on the cover, which is always a little bit tricksy given the prevailing atmosphere in the Formula One world at the moment. But, you know, it's his second world title, so he merits the cover very much. We unpick the burning questions around Max's second driver's title. Is he the unstoppable and ever-improving juggernaut? Is it a case of just having the fastest car while Mercedes have failed to offer enough of a challenge? The answer is more nuanced than anything you'll find on Twitter, that's for sure. Certainly, the strange polarisation of responses from people saying, I couldn't even open the packet, it's going straight in the bin, to the people who've been attempting some sort of Da Vinci Code style unpicking of the wording on the cover to suggest that we are somehow subtly diminishing Max's achievements by putting him on the cover and saying it's a great championship. I'm not sure quite how far one has to go into the rabbit hole to adopt that mentality. Anyway, amongst other things, Dr. Helmut Marko says Max is now a much more mature driver. And, you know, as the only person with a mustache in this virtual room, Matt, you probably have an opinion on that.
Absolutely. With my exquisitely thin sunglasses I was wearing in Abu Dhabi, I was representing the 1970s world, so I can take on this more sort of sage persona for this podcast to talk about Max Verstappen, who is in fact younger than me. Is he mature, more mature? I think a lot of that boils down to how his race Charles Leclerc this season compared to how his race Lewis Hamilton. And if there was any sort of doubts about or conflating the idea of Max maturing and his having fewer accidents this season, I think when he has eventually tripped over Lewis Hamilton, you know, more recently Brazil, you see that there is still something independent of any relationship he has with other drivers, whether it's, you know, tripping over Esteban Ocon in Brazil or whatever. There is certainly something about how Lewis and Max treat one another compared to other drivers. I think particularly this year, so if you're looking at the Brazil incident, an eighth world title was long gone for Lewis Hamilton by then. So perhaps it's more about the mentality, and Max has already wrapped his up. But certainly he's raced Leclerc a lot better. If you think, you know, some of the duels, what about Austria? Okay, so the Red Bull was clearly the second fastest car there, but he really didn't put up too much resistance to Leclerc. It wasn't a leave it all on the line. Monaco was that cliched Alain Prost performance where he was happy to follow his teammate home and not get his elbows out needlessly. So in that sense, I think he is more mature. I also think it comes with, you know, year-on-year gains. Yes, he's been operating at an extremely high level, so he's not suddenly going to come into each new season half a second up the road. That just doesn't happen, but he can still focus on the details, make incremental improvements. What has he been? Eight full seasons, I think it is now. Something, you know, incredible. So he's not, it's all about the minutiae. Again, to bring it back to his maturity, I suppose you could cite the radio outbursts that he still has with his race engineer, Giampiero Lambesi. So, you know, I won't repeat some of the choice language he had about the the substandard pit stop in the United States. But he still gets very angry, still gets very heated. But I think people take that at face value. It's him swearing in the heat of the moment. But Max has talked quite a lot about, well, the reason I can do that now is because we have such a good rapport that it means nothing. I can call him every word under the sun in the heat of the moment, but we both know that that's because I'm racing at 170 miles an hour. And when we get out the car, me probably having won, it's still sweetness and light. So in that sense, I think he lets the small things slide more. But to contradict myself, we're just doing this after Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, where a lot of the pre-race press conference was about team orders, understandably, because of what happened with Perez. And then when you're talking about maturity, Max is peddling this narrative of the media, they give me such a hard time. They don't understand what's going on. And so the question from the media was, Max, what's been going on so that we can understand and give you a fair portrayal? And he says, I won't tell you about it. So maybe in that sense, that contradiction proves that there's still a bigger worldview to have, or he can do more to help his own cause. But certainly when he's behind the wheel of a car, I think he is a more mature racer. But I that's not to say he's the most mature racer, I think, is how I'd probably end my opening salvo, Connors.
Because of the exigencies of magazine production, it's not like the internet. You don't click send and it appears nanoseconds later. A monthly magazine is a venerable steamship that has to go and get printed and stuck in the post, etc., etc. So this issue of GP racing was completed before the Brazilian Grand Prix and in the post during that weekend, landed on subscribers' doormats the day afterwards, and of course on the newsstands just before the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix. So the material in it will not have reflected the matters arising from Brazil and Abu Dhabi. But yeah, like you say, there's this sort of strange, which we will come back to, a kind of bunker mentality within Red Bull at the moment. I mean, Mark, you know, do you find that understandable, that there's this sort of prickliness when dealing with the press? Or is it more of a naivety? It's sort of like, if you don't say what I want you to say, then you're my enemies and I'm not going to speak to you.
I'm not sure if it's naivety. I think that there's been a 12-month kind of war of words and lobbying and spin doctoring within Formula One, Mercedes on one side and Red Bull on the other. And you know, you've mentioned Twitter a couple of times already in the introduction. The social media has been divided, with the lovers of Lewis and Max and the haters of Lewis and Max. You know, it's all become incredibly binary and actually fairly toxic environment. And I think that toxic environment feeds through to a lot of the individuals in the sport, like Max. You know, you think about the people around Max, his girlfriend, his parents, Helmut Marko, the team. He'll be getting lots of different lines of communication. We know he accesses social media himself. I spoke to Christian Horner very briefly about the topic of social media a couple of weeks ago, and he said to me, you know, he just doesn't look at it. He tries to avoid it as much as possible because it's just it's obviously such a negative environment. And I think it's not unsurprising that a 25-year-old who's at the peak of his career will get upset by some of the things that he hears and reads that people are saying about him, particularly if they're projecting things on him that he fundamentally disagrees with. So I think that there's a lot coming from the narrative around the sport over the last 12 months that Max will have found quite irritating. How he won his first championship, how he's won his second championship. And of course, the reality is it was Michael Massey who made the decisions that enabled Max to win the championship at the final race last year. It wasn't Max. Max did what he was required to do, and he won the race and he won the championship. And in terms of his maturity, well, you can't win 15 Formula One Grand Prix without being an incredibly mature and consistent and fast Formula One driver. And that's what he's been this year. He's been the class of the field, shown a very clean pair of heels to his teammate, who's no slouch. I completely agree with Matt when it comes to the competition between him and Charles at Ferrari. Max has been, you know, outstanding. It's been very clean. He's, you know, risen to the task of being the number one driver in Red Bull against the number one driver in Ferrari, who was scoring all those pole positions on a Saturday and leaving Max with a little bit of extra work to do on a Sunday. But he was incredibly relaxed about it. And when we think about those races where Max had penalties and had to come from further down the grid, I'm thinking particularly, for example, of Belgium as one example, and the confidence that he had in himself and the car to come through the field and, you know, take the win. So huge amount of confidence there. At the Italian Grand Prix, I had the opportunity to work with Max on a one-to-one basis at an event with one of their corporate partners. And, you know, he strode into the room. We hadn't really any chance to do much of a briefing. Straight into the session, talking to very high-level executives. And I thought to myself, my goodness, 25 years of age, you know, he's got so much confidence. He is so articulate. He's able to answer questions about any facet of his performance, the season, the team, the car, the competition, the track, the, you know, every facet. He's on absolutely on top of his game. So I think there's a lot of maturity there. And therefore, you know, Helmut Marko is right to say that Max has really matured into it. Again, Matt, picking up on something you said, you know, when it comes to Lewis, actually, I don't know why anyone's surprised that Max treats Lewis differently. You should treat Lewis differently because he's been the dominant driver of this era. I remember going back a long way, having a conversation with Michael Schumacher when he had gone to Benetton, and the man was Ayrton Senna and Alain Prost at the time. But I mean, we specifically spoke about Senna, and I remember Michael saying to me, you know, he's the guy. He's the guy I have to beat. And you know, once you give an inch, you know, he's going to destroy you. So you have to be as hard as nails as regards Senna, not really worried about anyone else. Which, I, you know, people took that as Michael being arrogant, but actually he was being incredibly accurate. You know, Ayrton was the guy that he really needed to beat and needed to worry about. So in many respects, when I see those collisions, such as happened in Brazil, I think, well, actually, this is quite normal because Max knows that the moment he rolls off the throttle, gives way to Lewis, he's giving way to the one guy who can absolutely stop Max ever becoming the dominant driver in Formula One over the current regulations. And of course, Max has had an easier run of it this year because the Mercedes has not been a great car. W13, worst name ever. Why did they call it 13? They were just begging for trouble. You know, the Mercedes took a risk with their innovative design, lots of unintended consequences, took them a long time to learn where they were. So actually, Max has really only had to worry about Ferrari as such. And that has made his life easier, but he's taken advantage of it. And when you look at past years, you know, Ayrton Senna takes advantage of his opportunities, or Alain Prost, or Michael Schumacher, or Mika Hakkinen, or Fernando Alonso, I mean, or Sebastian Vettel. Who doesn't take advantage of being in the best car in a season when other people are having difficulties? So I think, you know, when I read online about, oh, Max has got a real problem with Lewis. Well, of course, Max has a problem with Lewis. He thinks Lewis Hamilton, and he thinks this is a guy who's won over 100 Grand Prix, 7 World Championships, could have won an eighth if it wasn't for what happened in Abu Dhabi, etc., etc. So Max absolutely is, I think, dealing with Lewis in a different way. And then if I do come to just a final point on the Max thing, yes, he gets emotional on the radio. Lots of drivers do. You know, we've heard at birth from pretty well everyone at some point. It shows how much he cares about winning. It shows, I don't think, a lack of maturity. I think it shows huge excitement and determination to get the job done. And I think for those few moments where you get emotional outbursts, actually, they're few and far between compared to what he's actually concentrated on doing very well, which is winning Grand Prix after Grand Prix this year. 15 Grand Prix wins, 17 times on the podium, and the 22 races. I mean, it's as good a season as you could possibly have hoped for. And I recall a particular moment after the third race when he had had two retirements in three races. And I was listening to him giving an interview, and I thought, there's a mature Max Verstappen, because he should have been gutted. And he actually looked quite relaxed. He was like, we know what the problems are. The main thing is we've got a quick car. We'll get on top of this. And then, I mean, effectively, he was saying, you won't see me for dust once we get this sorted. And he was absolutely spot on. So I think, you know, he's done a lot of growing up. And it'll now be interesting to see what happens next year, because if George and Lewis come back strongly at Mercedes, and if Ferrari can ramp their game up a little bit, it won't be such a straightforward opportunity for Max to do what he did this year.
It was like Max was pitching a rejected two Ronnie sketch after Australia, after the second retirement. He said, I think to get back in title contention, I need 45 races. And we had to go, 425 races? No, 45 races.
I'd never expected to have a two Ronnie's reference, but that was brilliant. It was almost four candles. People do forget that the car was overweight and a little bit unreliable at the beginning of the year. So it's one of those things, isn't it? Peak end effect. People remember what happens nearer the end. Unfortunately, adding fuel to the social media rage in the Verstappen haters camp is the question we sort of have to come onto next, which is the matter of Red Bull exceeding the budget cap, apparently, as I referenced at the top of the show, darlings, because of the catering bill, amongst other things. You know, in Christian Horner's rather peculiar peroration in the Mexican Grand Prix weekend, he suggested that journalists eating his sandwiches were among the reasons for going over the budget cap. And I've struggled to remember when journalists were actually last allowed in the Red Bull motorhome, let alone offered grub. Anyhow, we can laugh about some of the minutiae in this case, but on the one hand, you have Red Bull saying the punishment is disproportionate and could cost them in terms of lap time over the next two seasons. On the other, you have the likes of Ferrari saying the punishment and the deterrent isn't strong enough. And Red Bull also claimed that information about the case had been leaked to the press beforehand around the Singapore weekend via another team, mentioning no names, but they meant Mercedes, of course. And funny enough, just this morning before we started recording this podcast, we heard that Charles-Anne Rowe, the lawyer who joined the FIA from Mercedes a few months ago, has just left the FIA. So yeah, her departure was announced this morning. Some people might say that this is pandering to Red Bull's paranoia. I mean, Mark, what would you say about that?
I think the penalty was quite stiff. Adrian Newey is rather famous for his aerodynamic genius and the fact that they have a substantial 10% reduction in the runs that they can do, wind tunnel runs that they can do, CFD testing, is significant. It's going to hurt them, no doubt about that. People will already be screaming, listening at this, saying, yes, but they overspent last year, which meant that they built such a competitive car for this year, and that's given them a head start, et cetera, et cetera. I've heard all of that. When you look at the detail and you consider that the overspend in the cost cap was 1.6%, well within the 5% limit for a minor breach, so 1.6%. And that actually most of that was to do with a tax credit on research and development. And if that was taken out, actually, they exceeded the cost cap by about 0.37%, so less than 0.4%. Again, I've discussed this with Christian Horner, who said to me, it's, in his view, such a small amount of money, completely accepts the fact that it was more than the cost cap, completely accepts that, but feels that the $7 million fine, you know, was a pretty substantial penalty for them to have to pay, plus the restrictions on aero testing. So my own view in terms of having listened to the whole thing, and as you know, I've written a couple of features for the magazine in the last 2 years on the budget cap, is that it's really interesting to hear people like Mattia Binotto telling us all how much faster you can make a car for $500,000. Because if the numbers that he's giving are true, well, I'm surprised Ferrari haven't won the world championship every year for the last 20 years. Because apparently you can get an entire tenths of seconds for, you know, a few hundred grand. Well, we know that that's not the case. We know it's a lot more complicated than that. Of course, Mercedes-Benz, and I don't blame Mercedes-Benz for this. Mercedes-Benz absolutely pushing as hard as they can to make Red Bull suffer for what's happened under the cost cap. I mean, I completely understand that. This is all to do with the aftermath of Abu Dhabi last year. There was utter fury at Mercedes over what happened last year, and that fury has not diminished. It'll never disappear. I don't think Toto Wolff, as long as he's alive, will ever quite get over what happened in Abu Dhabi, because he knows that what Michael Massey did on that day robbed Lewis Hamilton of an eighth Drivers' World Championship, and that hurts them deeply, and possibly even contributed to the way in which this year's car evolved in their efforts to try and, you know, win another title. So there's a lot to unpack from that. And I understand the fury at Mercedes, and I understand the degree to which they wanted Red Bull to feel pain and humiliation over the cost cap breach. But again, when the rules were drafted, the rules imagined, everyone involved in creating those rules imagined what would happen if you had a marginal breach, a minor breach. And there's no secret about that. There is a minor breach. A minor breach is allowed for. There are penalties. The penalties have been applied. The minor breach is not cheating. It's not called cheating. It's not done with a degree of intention. Not a single man or woman who walks in the doors of Bradbourne Drive in Milton Keynes goes to work to cheat to try and win the Formula One championship. Not Christian Horner, not Adrian Newey, not any of the people who work for them. So what's happened is actually more to do, in my view, with competence and accuracy and reporting structures, and a lot more to do with process than to do with anyone sitting saying we're going to try and stretch the budget so that we can destroy the competition by spending more money than them. It's been a very significantly difficult period of time for Christian, particularly for Christian, you know, on a personal level, and a very uncomfortable sequence of Grand Prix for him to sit in press conferences and talk to the media to explain what's happened, to explain away what's happened. And I think one of the things which has struck me, to do with Max, to do with Christian, to do with Red Bull, has been slightly the need for a more coordinated communication strategy around all of these points. Something that Mercedes are very good at doing. You know, Mercedes have an extremely effective director of communications in Bradley Lord. He is very much a right-hand person to Toto Wolff. I don't get the impression that Red Bull is quite structured in that way to handle crisis in quite the fashion that perhaps Mercedes have done. I think that's just a comment that I would have about their ability to respond to these points. So I think the way arguments were presented lacked a little bit in terms of the nuance, and that just left gaps for the media to step in and fill. And it left Christian with, I felt, quite an uncomfortable number of weeks as a result. But fundamentally, what's happened has happened. You know, there was a minor breach. They got a significant penalty. Financially, $7 million is still a sensible amount of money. It's, you know, that's not a small amount of money. And definitely the development restriction is something that they will deeply have not wanted to suffer.
I'd like to follow up on a couple of Mark's points. First of all, I thought it was interesting that it became a joke on social media that Red Bull were then advertising for the position of an accountant, and similarly Alpine advertising for a position of contract lawyer. Of course they would be if they fell. Well, no, but of course they fell foul of that. So they need to improve that department. So I why wouldn't they advertise? I would say that, you know, it's an easy argument to make. I get it was only a small overspend and it was tax discrepancy, but obviously no other team fell foul of that. Given it was such a small amount, I don't, you know, I think there's probably a bit too much from Mercedes that when their comments are, well, we're watching Red Bull bringing all these upgrades, they must have been going way, well, it wasn't that much. It wasn't, you know, an entirely new car. I understand all the pain around Red Bull and the controversy that's caused, but I think the bigger picture is that Audi wouldn't be joining Formula One, and Porsche's interest wouldn't have been so great if there wasn't a cost cap. That we know that to be true, and it's for the health of the sport. So I understand why the sanctity of it has to be preserved. You know, there's some people whose opinion is very much, it was a bit of penny over, they deserve the same sort of fine, whether you believe it's draconian or not, just to preserve this thing so that Audi, whoever, are still interested. But I suppose if you are a Red Bull fan, you can take some comfort in knowing that, yes, you have lost this 10%, but as long as then with subsequent years, you stick within the budget cap, as you've seen from the RB18, aero isn't the only way to go. You can still, you know, not put that car in a wind tunnel, but take a load of weight out to make it right at the, you know, not even so that you meet the 7, 9, 8 kilo minimum weight limit. It's so that you get a long way under that, so then you can position the ballast where you want to suit your drivers. It's what we've seen with Verstappen. He likes it all over the nose, and it doesn't matter if the rear is oversteering. So while they might not be able to, you know, let Adrian Newey run wild, it's not to say that then they're going down a development dead-end path, which is, you know, for obviously not what Mark was stating, but it's you know, yes, it's an expensive fine and it will hurt them, but it's not, there is light at the end of the tunnel, I suppose.
Yeah, so much of F1 nowadays is about tyre management, isn't it? And building a car that looks after its tyres is one thing. Having a driver that can then maximise tyre life is another. And, you know, if we just look back at the events of last weekend, Max was able to do a one-stop strategy because he's become one of F1's preeminent tyre whisperers, whereas Perez was opening up his right front tyre and had to make two. So even if he hadn't been suckered into a second pit stop by Ferrari, Matt's about to disagree with me.
No, not
maybe
at all.
I went off to make a cup of tea at the vital moment.
Not at all. I was just saying, you know, that was for a long time seen as Perez's bread and butter. Now, do we believe that ground effect has made him terrible at tyre management? No. But does that mean it's a massively underappreciated string in Verstappen's bow? Quite possibly.
Max has become, the as I said, the preeminent tyre whisperer, and other drivers who perhaps have cars that are slightly harder on their tyres now are finding it really, really hard to, you know, A, keep up in a timely fashion in races, and B, manage the strategy. So I suppose from that point of view, we can also say Ferrari leave the season on an uplifting note, having actually caught their strategy right for once. So elsewhere in the magazine this month, we have the lost interview with Dietrich Mateschitz, obviously the founder of the Red Bull brand, who died a few weeks ago on the eve of the Austin Grand Prix. And it was very interesting because he founded this very brash, go-getting brand which marketed itself through extreme sports, but it was actually quite reclusive. He was very difficult to get hold of. He didn't do interviews. He was basically, as billionaires go, he was the quantifiable opposite of Elon Musk. And we were very fortunate that a few years ago our former editor Anthony Rowlandson did an interview with him for the F1 Opus, that massive carbon fiber thing, which I'm not sure ever got published. Certainly none of the people who wrote for it ever actually got paid. So we've been able to present this interview as freshly minted as the day it was born. And what interested me about it, and why I thought we should publish it, was it was very much done at the dawn of Red Bull's era in Formula One. So not only did we have access to a massively reclusive person who never really spoke, but also he described in great detail what his vision for the team was and what he'd said to the people that he'd just basically bought as employees and what he expected from them. And to read that in the context of what's been achieved, I thought was really, really interesting. And also, you know, Mark, you encountered Dietrich Mateschitz in that era. You've written about him in this month's issue, so you have some very personal memories of speaking to him.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fact that Dietrich is an extraordinary figure in the history of Formula One, to have come in essentially as a fan from the 1960s. He used to drive around Europe following his hero Jochen Rindt, and who then went off into working in marketing in pharmaceutical companies and ended up as a marketeer for a toothpaste brand in Germany, and then found himself in Asia on a business trip and encountered the drink, which went on to become Red Bull. I think he first came across it in 1984. By 1987, he had produced the first Red Bull drinks in Austria, outsourcing the manufacturing to a company called Rauch. So if you look at the side of Max's car this year, you'll see the oval Rauch logo. And that company, Jürgen Rauch's company, is the company that produced and produces Red Bull for the European market in Austria. So, you know, the story of Dietrich, of how he then came back to Formula One as a sponsor, having been a fan, starting with Gerhard Berger, and then suddenly November 2004, he acquires the Jaguar racing team from Ford Motor Company and proceeds to turn up at the factory and have a town hall meeting where he stands on stage in front of everyone and says, "Good morning, I'm Dietrich Mateschitz. You now work for Red Bull Racing. My vision is to win the Formula One World Championship within 5 years." And I think people were incredulous that the team had been sold. I mean, most people in the room were worried they wouldn't have a job by Christmas time. So the team has been successfully sold, but it's been sold not to a car company, but to this energy drinks guy. And Dietrich's vision for what he was going to do with Red Bull Racing was so clear, crystal clear from day one. And there are not many people in Formula One, and in fact not many people in the world of business, who do what they say they're going to do in terms of their ambitions and realizing their ambitions. I mean, how many teams have we heard saying we have a 3-year or a 5-year plan? It's a couple of teams here perennially in the midst of a transitional plan. Red Bull had a 5-year plan to get to the forefront of Formula One. They delivered that, because by the end of second half of 2009 they started dominating the sport. And then, you know, the rest is history with Sebastian winning those four titles. And Dietrich just brought an incredible focus to everything he did. He employed the best people he could find. I know I've spoken, Cotters, with you before on a podcast about the fact that when Dietrich took David Coulthard on board in 2005, David was at the tail end of his career. He knew that. And yet Dietrich said to him, "Well, your job is to tell me what do we need to do to be like Williams or McLaren, to be like the teams that have won all those championships. What do we need to do?" And of course, one of the things that David helped him to identify was that you need to get Adrian Newey, and then went and helped to achieve that. And, you know, we talked about Christian Horner earlier on, in relation to Max and in relation to the cost cap. I understand lots of fans don't like Christian, because there's lots of fans who feel terribly affronted by what happened in Abu Dhabi last year, which again, I'll reiterate, was a Michael Massey decision. It wasn't a Christian Horner decision. The fact remains that Christian Horner has been an extraordinarily successful team principal now 17 years in Formula One. There's not many people who could do what he has done. And Dietrich Mateschitz was a tough guy to work for. So Christian has had to deal with someone who was, yes, very supportive, but also incredibly demanding. You know, there's a reason why Christian has Helmut Marko there at his shoulder the whole time, Helmut reporting to Dietrich, keeping pressure on the team, yes, supporting them, but also demanding results, results, results. So Dietrich, a very, very driven guy in every sense. I only worked with him for a short time, but it's now a time I look back on and very much cherish, because I was able to spend one-to-one time with him in meetings, talking about strategy, talking about where the team was going to go. And I've written in the column about going to a meeting with him in Madrid, where he asked me to come with him, and we got on board his private jet and we flew down to Madrid together. And I watched him operating, and to see this guy who was already a billionaire sitting in a meeting with an oil company, it was Repsol, and saying to Repsol, "You know, I'd like you to sponsor my team in Formula One." And he wasn't saying this because he needed Repsol's money. He was saying this because he wanted Repsol's partnership, because he viewed it as really important that the team gathered together the right group of partners, just as he was gathering together the right group of people. Christian Horner, young, up-and-coming team principal, David Coulthard, giving the benefit of his experience. Adrian Ewing, a preeminent designer, you know, he liked surrounding himself with the right people, the right partners. And I remember sitting in that meeting and listening to how he was selling to Repsol the fact that, you know, if you sponsor my Formula One team, I could sponsor your MotoGP team. I could partner with you in MotoGP, and maybe we could do DTM together. You know, we could essentially partner with each other across different disciplines. And by adding together all of those programs that we're committed to, we can create something very special. So he was enormously focused as an individual. And obviously, I haven't worked with him in over a decade and a half. I have met him. I met him a couple of occasions just socially in that time. But when you talk to an Adrian or a Christian or a Sebastian or a David Coulthard or a Max or a Helmut Marko, they all say the same thing about Dietrich's love of Formula One, his passion for the sport, his fantastic support that he gave everyone to achieve their ambitions. And yeah, of course, a tough businessman. You don't achieve what he did by not being a tough businessman. But ultimately, he produced the result. And it is definitely a sad moment for Formula One to have lost him, because he absolutely, in my view, is right up there with an Enzo Ferrari or a Colin Chapman or, you know, a Ron Dennis or a Frank Williams. You know, Dietrich is one of those people who made Formula One what it looks like today. And his passing is definitely it's a sad moment.
It will be interesting to see whether Lawrence Stroll achieves something similar with Aston Martin, because it's all about culture and, as you say, employing the right people, isn't it? And sometimes I look at what Lawrence has done with some elements of Aston Martin, and it's almost like sometimes you see a company that has partners and shareholders, and it's the CEO or the boss or whatever makes what you might call C-suite appointments. They sort of pack out the C-suite with big names in order to create the impression of moving forward. Whereas you've got the impression that with Red Bull Racing, that never happened. It was a case of Mateschitz hiring people like Christian Horner and Adrian Newey, who had a track record of success, and empowering them and to transform the culture of the team rather than just sort of packing out the C-suite.
I cannot quite believe that one of the first things that Fernando Alonso said when he walked into the garage in Abu Dhabi was that the Aston Martin looks like a Jaguar, because the last thing that Aston Martin want to be associated with is what Jaguar was, which was exactly, to your point, all about appointing lots of C-suites, lots of leaders, lots of people with huge titles, vice president of this and president of that and chief whatever. It doesn't make any difference. I mean, what you need is results, and results come from incredibly well-structured, well-led teams of people with a team principal who has complete authority over the whole enterprise. And when you have team principals who actually don't have complete authority, who themselves are reporting through a chain of command within the overall team structure, the team principal's not at the top. That to me is always a warning sign. And I think, you know, I'm saying that in relation to Aston, because I mean, all of the people that we know are there, Mike Crack and Martin Whitmarsh, and, you know, all of the senior people there. I've no doubt they all jump out of bed each day really focused on trying to bring that team to the front in Formula One. But again, going back to the Dietrich Mateschitz story, one of the things that Dietrich felt very strongly about is that Formula One teams need to be run as a motor racing team with a team boss. And he appointed a team boss in terms of Christian Horner. Why did they employ Christian? Because they'd already been working with him in Formula 3000, and they knew that he ran a tight ship. And they gave him a massive opportunity. They said, here's your big break, and now it's over to you. And he ran with it. And he is the team principal. He is the chief executive of that team. And yes, he has Helmut Marko as the person within the Red Bull organization that he has to relate to. But Helmut's not running the team on a day-to-day spaces, it was left to Christian to do that. So a huge amount of empowerment, and then a very simple structure within Red Bull Racing. I mean, you could almost say that Christian and Adrian are rather akin to a Ron Dennis and a John Barnard, or a Patrick Head and a Frank Williams. You know, it's quite a simplistic structure. You know, team boss who runs all of the politics, the commercial, the, you know, that side, and then a technical boss. And so Dietrich felt that that was the right way to run a Formula One team. In many ways, a kind of 1990s structure for a team that was created in the mid-2000s, but it certainly worked. Red Bull haven't had to produce lots of chief executives or vice presidents of this, that, or the other thing. They just run a very simple structure, and it clearly works extremely well. So, you know, I think to your point, Lawrence Stroll is in Formula One for quite different reasons. Yes, he loves Formula One. I'm sure every bit as much as Dietrich Mateschitz loves Formula One, but Lawrence Stroll has created the Aston Martin Formula One team to effectively help in his goal of building Aston Martin into a super successful car company and to be the marketing of Aston Martin in the same way that Ferrari used Formula One. And that's a much, much, much bigger task that he has taken on. Red Bull weren't trying to build a car company off the back of Formula One or use Formula One for the marketing of a car company. Red Bull already had a super, super successful, massively profitable business in the Red Bull energy drink. And so Formula One just became part of that global marketing strategy. In many respects, Lawrence Stroll has taken a huge gamble on the car company and the Formula One team. And Double Six has to come up for it to achieve everything he wants. He really needs to have an extraordinary outcome. And that's going to be much more difficult. And I think, therefore, it'll be very difficult for Lawrence to achieve the legacy that Dietrich has as easily, simply because Lawrence has given himself a much, much bigger task. And the problems at the Aston Martin car company are, of course, very public and ongoing.
Question is, has Lawrence taken on a gamble too far in employing Fernando Alonso? Judging by Matt Kew's driver ratings from the most recent Grand Prix, possibly so. Comprehensively beaten by his teammate, I think was the phrase used by Matt in his controversial driver's ratings. And we have an interview with that teammate in this month's issue. Luke Smith has spoken to Esteban Ocon, who had made a little bit of a thing about the fact that he's done better as Fernando's teammate than anybody since Lewis Hamilton, I think, was the thing. Now, Jenson Button chafed slightly at that statistic, but we chewed over that and felt it was quite rigorous. The question was, while Fernando was trying to brush it off, it looked like it had got under his skin a little bit, because there was that contretemps between Alonso and Ocon in Brazil. I mean, Matt, were you surprised to see that coming together, given what was brewing?
Can I start by defending my ratings? I got accused by my boss of being ageist because I gave Alonso and Hamilton not bad scores. This is a slight tangent, but you know, I believe that anything six and above constitutes a good score. But you know, I think we're living in.
Oh yes, this isn't a computer game review where seven out of ten is actually a bit crap. 5 out of 10 is average.
Yes, and I'm happy to defend these scores. I got taken to task by them by Lando Norris in Bahrain, but I did threaten him with a dock of several places in the Autosport top 50 unless he conceded that my driver ratings were always brilliant. We beg to differ on that one. Although I would rate his one-on-one interview skills 10 out of 10. That's a tangent. On the Ocon, first of all, hat tip to Luke Smith, who wrote it. I don't want to speak on his behalf, but I think, having spoken to him about that piece in particular, I think he really enjoyed doing it. You know, Esteban's a really charming person, great value for F1, and despite the success and the win and his high profile, it's you know, you can never accuse Esteban of having been corrupted by F1. He's a brilliant personality, and I think Luke absolutely sort of relished speaking to him. On that teammate duo, I'm always hesitant when there's any element of recency bias, But Esteban certainly has picked up his game over the second half of the season. Certain sources at Alpine tell me that although he's under lock and key with a very good contract, he was keen heading into the summer break to sort of haul management into the office and said, please stick with me, because the first half of the season wasn't very good at all. And this came alongside Alonso firing really on all cylinders. We spoke to him in Abu Dhabi and he said if he had had another year like 2021, he would have hung up his helmet. He didn't think he was good enough last year after his couple of years away in sports cars and Dakar. This year, I think by and large he's been mega qualifying. I wouldn't say it's has ever been his absolute greatest strong suit, but at the weekend he was done in by Ocon. But you know, as Ocon got better and they had this coming together, which the stewards did blame on Ocon rather than Alonso. It's not Alonso necessarily sort of creating the tension just before he's leaving, sort of ramming his teammate and going. And again, I suppose I don't want to blame it all on Ocon, but he has a track record for this, doesn't he? You know, with his former teammates, of course, Perez as well, famously at Racing Point, and now Alonso. But it was just sort of the one real incident where it got heated, just because they don't enjoy the sort of, you know, Lando Norris Ricardo or Lando Norris Carlos Sainz at McLaren era relationship doesn't mean that they're bitter rivals. But obviously, every F1 team, you know, you first benchmark is a person driving an identical machinery, so you can't expect someone, you employ someone to do a good job, you don't employ them to be necessarily, particularly in Formula One, a brilliant colleague. So if they don't get on, that's fine. However, I think Ocon still faces a question mark of can he be a team leader, and I think he faced that when Ricardo left, and I think he's facing that again when Alonso's left. So if he wants to like make his case around being the faster driver, and if that means coming together with Alonso in the sprint race and then the really clear team orders not to engage in the Grand Prix, then so be it. If that's he thinks, you know, I've got this Mr. Nice Guy persona and people have taken that as a weakness, therefore I must get my elbows out on track as a way to do it, then so be it. But you know, I know Alonso, I would also put that under, you know, the tension there. When Alonso's saying, you know, I'm just glad to get out, some of that is in deference to Ocon for a couple of incidences, but mainly it's the frustration he's felt with the Alpine unreliability, you know, Mexico and Abu Dhabi to go with, four other retirements, only one of which I think was a crash, which was with Hamilton in Spa. So I can understand the tension, but I don't think it's like it was a fundamentally broken relationship. I just think, you know, and the final point I'll make is that's Alonso's personality, isn't it? He, you know, the paddock joke is the Alonso tax, that everything he says is, you know, that was the best drive for 12th place you've ever seen. You know, I would be champion in this car if it wasn't for the, I'm driving best than I did when I won my championships. He's brilliant value for that, but there is always hyperbole. So I don't think it was quite the fracas that it was made out to be.
I mean, it's fair to say that Fernando's kind of been firing on all cylinders most of this year. Yeah. Just his engine hasn't.
Yes, quite exactly. He's been brilliant. I grew up watching him in 2005 and 6 championships and his McLaren teammate. And you know, obviously, I'm extremely fortunate to cover F1. But like with Vettel or Hamilton, when the W13 comes out, there's always, you know, I want to be able to tell my kids or you know, when I'm hauled on as a guest podcast or whatever medium it is in 30 years' time, that I saw these guys absolutely at their prime. And that doesn't necessarily, like Miss Jean Brodie, that doesn't necessarily mean fighting for race wins and championships, but seeing them being brilliant overlap or in wheel-to-wheel combat. And despite what being 41 now, Alonso has offered that absolutely in abundance this season. So zero downer on him. I don't want to make that plain.
Do we think we're going to see a little bit more of the same in terms of on-track fracas? Given that Ocon and Pierre Gasly are famously supposedly estranged, you know, as we've uncovered in the feature, cropping each other out of pictures on Instagram.
They say no. You know, they've had some photos together. I don't know whether you saw that to celebrate Vettel's retirement, they all went out for dinner and, you know, loads of drivers posted pictures from this event. And the thing that was interesting for me is just seeing who was stood where, you know, someone between Verstappen and Perez after the team orders, but Verstappen having his arm round Ocon after their clash. So there have been smiles in the press shots, obviously. You seldom seen them, you know, having that sort of rapport like other drivers do. And if I could read between the lines, obviously the narrative has been they don't get on because of, you know, supposedly one version of events is that supposedly Gasly came in and started beating Ocon in karting and, you know, was then the golden boy of France's next generation. Others say that maybe Gasly was a bit unkind about Ocon's appearance or something. You know, he was a more popular kid. Others say it's to do with you know, romance and whatever. So somewhere in between. But a bit of like off the record information. I was approached by someone very close to the Gasly camp to have a sit down interview to tell me exactly how well they got on. And when someone's going that above and beyond to tell me how good friends they are, makes me think that still that relationship has some potential to sort of boil over next season, particularly as they are not made in the mold of one each other, but they are obviously a similar age and you know, same nationality. As much as that might be a brilliant sort of poster child for success for Alpine, it also means that, you know, there will be tensions because if, as I said, Ocon hasn't made that team definitively his own and Gasly's using this as a way to get back up the grid, having cut ties with the Red Bull stable, that number one, you know, whether it's tacit or otherwise, is up for grabs. So of course they're going to scrap and there will be tensions and it will come bubbling back over and we'll be sure to write about it.
We will indeed, because, and just as a little précis, we do have an interview with Pierre Gasly in the forthcoming edition of GP Racing. Oleg Karpov did it just before the end of the season. So stay tuned for that. I read the proof just yesterday. Well, we've gone over our hour mark, and I know, Matt, you have to pull the eject switch because you've got the typically ridiculous Autosport writing schedule to obey, 8 million words of season review stuff to deliver by tomorrow morning. So it's time for us to say thank you to the listeners for putting up with another hour of this absolute madness. Thank you very much, Mark Gallagher, joining us at an unsociable hour from Adelaide. Cheers.
Thank you very much. I drank my glass of wine while listening to the roundup of the pending Gallic civil war at Alpine next season.
Well, help yourself to a top-up. Thank you very much for your time. Matt Q, thank you very much for your sagacity and wit and your luxuriant moustache. May it not be on my screen the next time we record a podcast. And thanks also to our producer, the long-suffering Martin Lee, who will have to cut out all the nonsense, by which time the podcast will probably only be about half an hour long. We will be back with you this time next month following the publication of the next edition of GP Racing. Thank you for listening. Well, that was quite entertaining.